36 years ago today, HPB left the physical body, not to return to it. 1891. Now, there are many occasions that are kept in mind by us, and some of you who have perhaps joined the Theosophical Society within the last few months or year or two may wonder why the anniversary of the passing of this great woman is yearly held to honor her, to remember her, to learn from her, and to try in some small way to follow her example. Now, there seems to be a very special undercurrent with regard to our thoughts of HPB, because she suffered calumny. She was called a trickster. She was deemed untruthful and unworthy, and she suffered greatly from the accusations that were hurled at her. And we, who know the falsity of it all, we who saw or have heard from those who were with her, saw the purity of her nature and the beauty of her character and the strength and the power of her will, we rather take an extra pleasure in meeting once a year to remind ourselves and the newcomers to the society of how wonderful she was. When Miss Graham was speaking just now of India and the experiences that Madame Blavatsky had in India in this and other incarnations, it just reminded me that in India there are two relationships between peoples that are special to the East. We do not find them very much in the West. We are rather too crude in that way. And those special relationships are, the highest is the relationship between the master and the disciple. The second is the relationship between the teacher and the pupil. Now, those are sacred. And we, of course, are new in that understanding of the relationships, and we grow a little more to understand them year by year as we follow the work and try to do it in the Theosophical Society. But now, there is another relationship which, though far less, is nevertheless very beautiful. And it is the relationship of the co-worker to his co-worker. That is, that if you want, for instance, to know what is the best in another person, try to work with them. And by working with them, you will find out the trials, the temptations, the strengths, the powers, and the accomplishment of your co-worker. Now, tonight, I have here with me some notes that are going to tell you what HPB's co-workers thought of her, how they loved her, how they trusted her, how they sympathized with her, and how they stood by her to the end. About 11 years ago, something happened straight from the blue to me, and it was that the postman delivered to me a book I had never seen before, and a book that I was very, very glad to receive. It was called H.P. Blavatsky, in memory of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky by some of her pupils. And I suppose there are about 20 small articles in the book. And I have not seen it anywhere else. Of course, I presume it's long out of print. But it was, these articles were collected immediately after her death and were printed, I believe, in the same year. And it's very interesting to know how a co-worker speaks of his leader. By the way, there is a biography of HPB, probably several, and in the one that I have seen, the biographer speaks of four characteristics of Madame Blavatsky, or rather of her life. She says, it was vigorous, brave, mysterious, and wonderful. Now, just a few examples of what her people thought of her. Tonight, I am not touching upon her occult powers. Her power to produce phenomena. It was very wonderful, ununderstandable, and was an immense help in the production of her greatest books, Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine. But I am not trying to estimate her occult powers tonight. I am just trying to bring you before you a very human person, and there is not one who has spoken of her that didn't love her. I have been very much surprised to find that anyone who knew her personally loved her. Now you'll hear some of the testimony. The first little quotation, I've only made short quotations of each, of just a few of the writers. The first is from G.R.S. Mead. At the ceremony of cremation, as we all know so well, the one great purpose of our teacher's life in this her present incarnation, a purpose which she pursued with such complete unselfishness and singleness of motive, was to restore to mankind the knowledge of those great spiritual truths we today call theosophy. Her unvarying fidelity to her great mission, from which neither contumely nor misrepresentation ever made her swerve, was the keynote of her strong and fearless nature. To her, who knew so well its true and inner meaning, theosophy was an ever-present force in her life. She was ceaseless in her endeavors to spread the knowledge of the living truths of which she had such full assurance. Now, the little article by Emily Kislingbury comes next. Emily Kislingbury knew HPB and Colonel Olcott in New York, and she describes her first meeting with them, and then goes on to say, "Just at that time, Isis Unveiled was going through the press, and many were the happy hours I spent correcting proofs and discussing the problems put forward in that marvelous book. There were fewer of the so-called phenomena, but what phenomena could well be greater than the production of HPB's monumental works in a language and a country which was foreign to her?" You know, that's very wonderful. Those wonderful books in a country and a language that was foreign to her. Unless it were the union of one individual of such great knowledge, such spiritual wealth, with so much geniality and consideration for the meanest brother who showed aspiration for truth or goodness. The charm of her personal presence, her brilliant conversation, her sallies of wit and humor, never failed to draw around her endless numbers of visitors. But it was only those who lived with her who could know how true and large, how generous and noble was the heart that beat within her. You see, my point about the co-workers. The others might admire and enjoy her wit and her hospitality and her geniality, but it was those who lived with her and worked with her who really knew. Now my next is a little bit from William Kingsland. He says, "There were those who were attracted by the magnetism of her personal influence, by her extraordinary intellect, by her conversational powers, and even by her militant unconventionality. It was her message that attracted me. She showed us the purpose of life. She taught us theosophy, not as a mere form of doctrine or a philosophy or a creed or a working hypothesis, but as a living power in our lives. The keynote of her teachings, the keynote of her life, was self-sacrifice. Individualism is the keynote of modern civilization. Competition and survival of the fittest, the practical basis of our morality. Our modern philosophers and scientific teachers show man's parentage, his ancestry, and his genius as belonging to the brute creation. What wonder, then, that one who believed so ardently in the divine nature of man, in the divine law of love, should oppose such conclusions. Some few years ago, she was at death's door. Humanly speaking, she ought to have died then. She herself knew she was dying and rejoiced. But the Master came to her, showed her the work that must still be done, and gave her her choice, the bliss of dying or the cross of living. She chose the cross. Now, there was one Charles Johnston who was amongst those who loved her and who served her. He says, all through her life, the dominant note of Madame Blavatsky's character has been power. In early years, power without light. Then later, power and light in equal balance. The earliest record of her life shows her as a strong and dominant personality, yet with an ever-present imperious generosity and gentleness, a deep generosity of thought, almost incredible generosity of action. Now, I don't know whether you've heard, but I seem to remember hearing in the long ago that on one occasion she was going from England to New York and had engaged her cabin on a good ship, and a widow with some children, one or more children, appeared on the scene in great distress. There seemed some urgent reason for her to go to New York, and she had no money. And HPB got a steerage passage for herself and spent the rest of the money that she had put down for her cabin in getting those people to New York. That seems to be an example. When I read this, I thought, yes, probably that was perfectly true. And that is an example of her almost incredible generosity of action. She was a powerful personality, using its power often extravagantly, often unwisely in her youth. Then the light dawned for her, and the chaotic strength of the nature was illuminated, harmonized, purified, and with the same dominant power, she prepared to deliver her message to mankind, the message of the strong to the weak, of one who stood within the circle of light to those in the darkness without. With unparalleled force, she asserted the soul. With transcendent strength, she taught the reality of spirit by living the life and manifesting the energies of an immortal. An immortal spirit. She had the courage to live as an immortal spirit and to subject material nature to the powers of her immortality. She perpetually took her stand on the realities of spiritual nature and consistently refused to admit the dominant tyranny of the material world. Of course, that became one of the big things she did, which was to stop the flood of materialism in the thought world. And this dominant power and this clear interior light were united to a nature of wonderful kindness, wonderful gentleness, and absolute self-forgetfulness and forgiveness of wrong. Now, when I come to that word, that phrase, and forgiveness of wrong, it reminds me that in my recent reading, I noticed that one of the writers in this book, speaking of her power to forgive, brought up the dreadful indignity and accusations that had been hurled at Madame Blavatsky by the Kulum people, Madame Kulum and her husband. And this writer said, if those two people had presented themselves at her door in London, starving and in rags, she would have taken them in. She would have fed them. She would have clothed them. And no, she had no thought of forgiveness. That is, that she never harbored. She never harbored in her thought all the injury that they had done her. But it would have come perfectly natural to her to serve them according to their need and to treat them with the utmost kindness. She seemed incapable of retaliation, therefore incapable of forgiveness, for it wasn't necessary. That seemed to me the touch of almost superhumanity. Now I'll just read you one more. Or perhaps two. Herbert Burrows, a very well-known observer with HBB, says, referring to his introduction, he says, I was not foolish enough to look for miracles. I did not expect to see Madame Blavatsky float, nor did I crave for materialized teacups. But I did want to hear about Theosophy. Quickly, I learned that the so-called charlatan and trickster was a noble soul whose every day was spent in unselfish work, whose whole life was pure and simple as a child's, who never counted the cost of pain or toil if these could advance the great cause to which her every energy was consecrated. And another, one of her first letters to me, phrased in her peculiar foreign way, informed me that the first volume of The Secret Doctrine was from the press. And, as she put it, I am up since 5 o'clock these days. That's in England, winter, cold. Her powers of endurance were equal in every respect to her great sense of devotion. I have seen her at her desk as early as 6 o'clock in the morning, and often in the coldest days of the winter months. Several sheets had passed under her pen before she took breakfast. Her application and tenacity were a source of wonderment to me. The night before she departed, she was at her desk for a few minutes. An editorial lay half completed upon her desk when for the last time she laid her pen aside. What though her untiring efforts in the cause of truth were repaid by slanders and scoffs and sneers, those who lived with her and best knew her can tell how inspiring was her teaching and example. And Annie Besant. Our nearness to her was not that of the bodily presence. It was that far closer tie which ever binds teacher and pupil in the venerable philosophy which it was her mission to impart. The work to which she gave her life is now ours to carry on. The forces behind it are not weakened because H.P. Blavatsky has departed. It is the work of the Brotherhood, not of any one individual. And while the Brotherhood lives and works, neither doubt nor despair can touch
They're disciples.
Now, brothers,
it is just when we review the opinion about her with people who knew, with people who served and toiled with her, we just realize that she brought theosophy. Without her self-sacrifice, without her knowledge, her work, the founding of the Theosophical Society would have been very, very greatly postponed. There was no other person in the world who had the psychic qualities that she had, and there was nobody who knew the truths sufficiently to found the society at the time that it was due to be founded. And besides bringing theosophy to us, the philosophy of it, the truth of it, you and I, just think, without it, we would not know of our septenary makeup, as it were. We would not know of the bodies that we use and the qualities we have to build in so that those bodies may become perfect instruments. And unless she had blazed the trail of discipleship, unless she had been faithful to her master, have trusted him and have learned from him, have suffered in a thousand ways in order to serve him, we should not have known of the possibility of treading the path. Now, don't let us forget H.P.B.'s wonderful piece that you generally, I suppose, recite perhaps at fellowship meetings, A Clean Life. You know how it goes. A clean life, an open mind, a pure heart, an eager intellect. I won't weary you with going on, but try to keep it in mind and realize those are the golden stairs up the steps of which we are all trying to climb. And because H.P.B. climbed them to such a height, she has shown that it can be done. What man has done, man can do. And as Annie Besant said, while the brotherhood lives, the disciples cannot perish.